And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post Podcast, live from an undisclosed location in New York City, New York, where I am very excited to be joined by truly one of the greatest coaches of all time, one of the most interesting people in the NBA, the longtime coach of the Dallas Mavericks and former coach of both the Pistons and the Pacers, Mr. Rick Carlisle. How are you?
I'm well.
You're well.
Good to be on the low post.
I don't think it is.
In the low post.
Yeah. It's a pun. See? It's a pun.
I got that.
Of the six and the coach of the 6-4 Dallas Mavericks coming off a tough loss to a very feisty Boston Celtics team. You are going into the proverbial lion's den in a couple of days in Madison Square Garden. Although the lions are not going to be out for you, they're going to be out for all sorts of other stuff. Have you talked to Porzingis at all about what the atmosphere is going to be like? And obviously the Fizdale stuff is brewing. Are you just like, or are you just lasered in on, let's just like the Knicks just beat us in Dallas. Let's beat them.
Well, it's, there's a lot going on right now. I mean, I think that's an accurate portrayal of the situation. And you know, the game in 2 days at the Garden is really a kind of a confluence of a lot of different things that are going on. The bottom line is they beat us. They played one of their best games of the year and they beat us 4 days ago or whatever it was. It was a disappointing loss for us at home, and we've got to bounce back from that. You know, in terms of everything going on with KP coming back, I don't need to get into a lot of that stuff. You know, he's aware that there's going to be a lot of attention on this game and so on and so forth. We've got to focus on ourselves as a team. We've got to focus on things that we need to do better that we haven't been doing well, in a couple of the last three games, you know, against New York and Boston. We struggled defensively in some areas and we got to spend time on that stuff tomorrow and get ourselves ready. And, it's a game on Thursday that I'm looking forward to because I think it's a good test for our team in terms of our ability to focus and bounce back.
It's very early. How would you evaluate the fit of Luka and Porzingis on offense so far?
The fit is great. I mean, those are just two high level offensive players. You got a guy with Luka's abilities as a ball handler, playmaker, scorer, you know, everything that he can do. He can post, he can pass it, he can drive it. You know, KP's a great shooter at 7'3". And, you know, KP's working his way back from a very unusual situation just in terms of the amount of time that he's been away. You know, it was 18 or 19 months. And I don't know if any NBA player has ever been offered that amount of time and then come back, but he's doing well. You know, it's been a little up and down, which we knew it was going to be. Mm-hmm. He's had a couple of really spectacular games. He had 32 against Portland. He had 28 against the Knicks, which was probably his best offensive game from the standpoint of, you know, rhythm and spacing and making reads. Last night in Boston was a tough night for him. You know, he had a poor shooting night, and so, you know, we have a day today to sort of gather ourselves. We got an important practice tomorrow, and then we play on Thursday.
A practice day in the NBA, unbelievable.
Yeah, every once in a while you get, you know, what I term a quality practice day, which means you've had one day to rest, you know, presumably an off day, and then you're set up basically to have a full live practice, and then you know, the game will follow the next day. And you know, the challenge there is to do the right amount of stuff, the right amount of competing, the right amount of, you know, skill building, development, refinement, those kinds of things. And the use of time in the NBA is one of the real challenges.
Yeah, I believe it. One of the things that's been interesting about the Luka KP fit is you're playing the two of them most of the time, if not almost all the time, with a rim runner like Powell, or Kleba is actually kind of a nice rim runner for you too. And it's been interesting to see, like, if you look at the numbers, Luka has run many more pick and rolls with those two guys than he has with Porzingis. And Porzingis is then spotting up around those guys. And I wonder, like, obviously you've noticed that, you're the coach. Those guys are elite rim runners. Luka's lob passing this year, I don't know what the heck you did to him in the summer, but the lob passing has been ridiculous. So accurate and so good. But are you worried at all that marginalizes Porzingis, or that you have a ways to go to sort of make them work together in a two-man game, like directly?
Yeah, some of this stuff is an ongoing work in progress. You know, one of the things that we're that you find in these situations is that, you know, there's so much switching now in the NBA. If you set up situations that are going to lead to switches, you've got to be careful about then rolling down into a, you know, kind of a slow moving isolation type situation, because, you know, these are very inefficient situations league wide. And so when we have our spacing, the way we like it, we're scoring the ball at a very, very high rate. And, you know, we're going to keep working on finding ways to integrate, you know, the combination of KP and Luka, both in a pick and roll situation and also with some off ball actions and some other things. And, you know, as you mentioned, we're pretty early in the process. So we're learning, we're communicating, and, you know, we're trying to make it better every day.
The switching and inefficient isolation thing, I'm jumping ahead on my question list, but I think one of the great forgotten playoff series of your career, you just nailed exactly what you did to the other team. I want you to see if you can guess it. The other team was a huge favorite in that series. It was the first round. I don't want to give it away too much, and it's within the last 8 years.
I don't know. Was it Boston?
No. No, the playoff series you were in as coach of the Mavericks.
Oh, the Mavericks. Oh, may have been San Antonio.
San Antonio, 2014. What do you, that series, like, it's, these great first round series sometimes get forgotten. You were the team that pushed the Spurs the hardest that entire playoffs. It came to a game seven. Now they blew you out, but that had like a Vince last second shot. That was like kind of a sneaky epic first round series. What do you remember from that? And what you did was if I recall, you put Marion on Tony Parker and you started switching a lot of their two man action to exactly what you just said, sort of take away their drive and kick stuff, right?
Well, you know, they were, prolific three-point team, and you know their pick and rolls with their five men led to a lot of situations where perimeter guys were having to tag the roller, and they moved it so well and they got into the lane so quickly that it was hard to get out to those guys. And so yeah, we did some things to get ourselves in a position to stay home on shooters a little more and make them, you know, take some tougher two-point shots. At least that was what the plan was. And, you know, in that particular series, we did a lot of great things. But where we really fell short was in game one, we had a real opportunity to win. And, you know, we had an 8 or 9 point lead, you know, early in the fourth quarter, and we're not able to finish the game. And if you're an underdog team on the road in the first two games of a playoff series, getting that first game is so important. Now, we did.
Changes everything, right? Changes the whole feel of the series.
Because playing from in front is really what it's all about analytically. If you look at, you know, how playoff series come down, you know, over, historically or whatever. We did win game two. And we did win game three when Vince hit the shot. But winning game one would have put us in a much stronger position to be in a game six situation at home with a chance to close it out. We didn't get there. We had to win game six to get to game seven. But yeah, and look, Zach, I think one of the things you're bringing up here that's interesting, and a lot of your listeners that do follow the game closely, and in great detail, and people that do remember that series, you know, the game has evolved so much since 2014. I mean, this is 5+ years now.
Yeah.
And back in those days, five out spacing was something that no one was talking about. And today it's the norm rather than the exception. And I believe the guy that did this first was Don Nelson at Golden State, you know, in the 2006-2007 time frame. You know, he put five guys around the perimeter, and you know, he would say basically, all right, guard us one on one and guard us in driving kick, and we dare you to try to stay in front of our, you know, Baron Davis and Steve Jackson and Monte Ellis and those guys, and then, you know, we're going to line up threes and we're going to make the game fast, and you got to play at our pace. And he was the first one that did it. It probably seemed gimmicky at the time, but that concept is something that today is really the signature of today's game.
If you talk to, but the Rockets were here last week, and D'Antoni and I were talking a little bit at this actual same location we're at now. If you talk to him about his son's teams, his big regret, other than all the stuff, the suspensions and stuff that happened to them in the playoffs, was, in retrospect, we didn't take it far enough. Nash should have shot more threes. I should have played Marion at the five sometimes. Like, we just didn't take it far enough. And it's interesting to hear him talk about it. He's like, we just didn't feel, we felt internally that everyone else felt it was a gimmick. And that got in our heads. It got in our heads that we're like, maybe we're being too unconventional. Maybe this really doesn't work. And it was just interesting to hear him talk about, like, that's his big regret.
Well, that is interesting. And, really the first team that was able to win playing smaller was Golden State. And they did it, speeding the game up in 2015. Their big adjustment in their series against Cleveland was to basically put Iguodala at the five, right? Well, I guess it was Green at the five. Iguodala came in, and then he or Barnes were the four men. And, they sped it up and played faster. And they did take it to an extreme. It's interesting that Mike said those things. His Phoenix teams were really, really, really difficult to play.
Oh, I imagine it was a nightmare. Then they're playing so much faster than everybody else.
I mean, when they were in their heyday, we had pretty good teams in Indiana when I was there, and we may have beaten them once or twice. And one of them was a game where Nash went out in the first quarter with, tweaked an ankle or something like that, so we got a little fortunate, because he was really the motor in the engine that was driving that whole thing to a large degree. But it's interesting that Mike would have those kinds of thoughts about it, but I understand where he's coming from.
Sometimes for inspiration, you just have to look up. For more than 60 years, the Goodyear blimp has fueled greatness on the gridiron by providing aerial coverage of some of the most legendary moments in college football history. When the Goodyear blimp rises above a stadium, it inspires players to reach higher and rise to the challenge of the game's biggest moments. Now it's your turn to go further with Goodyear. Discover tires made to rise above the rest. Learn more at Goodyear.com. Goodyear, more driven.
One last question on the Mavericks, then we're going to do rapid fire life of Rick Carlisle. I think you've used seven starting lineups already, six starting lineups, a lot of starting lineups.
Well, are you counting preseason?
No preseason.
If you count preseason, it would probably be four others.
No preseason. There's been Courtney Lee in, Courtney Lee out, do you care about settling on a starting five, or do you kind of like, maybe, I don't know.
I would love to settle on it.
Okay.
With the way our roster is structured, I'm not sure that a set starting lineup is in the offing, just because the ability to adjust is really an important thing to have. And while it is difficult on players, our guys have handled it as well as we could have asked them to handle it. But I would love to get to more consistency, but we'll see. We'll see, what's in the cards as we go the next five, six games.
Are you worried at all that Doncic is doing so much of the playmaking? Would you like to have a secondary ball handler out there with him that can do a little bit of the lifting for him? Because, it's hard to say, are you worried about a guy who's averaging a triple double and shooting like him? But it is interesting how much of the load he's taken.
It's a lot. I agree. We've looked at different lineups. I think Brunson has started.
He's good, man.
Brunson's a guy that guards pretty well, and he's a secondary playmaker.
It's a little fire hydrant out there.
Yeah, and 33rd pick in the draft. I mean, come on,
yeah,
man. And he's been terrific. And we've looked at Seth Curry in recent games because Seth's defense has picked up, and he does have playmaking ability, and he's an elite shooter. And so when you got a guy like Luka that can create, you want to put elite shooting around him so that he has even more space out there. But we'll see. With the analytic information that's available now, you can really get to a point where, you can look at your team in ways that 3, 4, 5 years ago we wouldn't have thought was even possible. And the important thing is to take the information that's pertinent, use it, apply it, and take all the noisy stuff and try to just put it to the side.
The guy, it's funny, the guy dumbass me thought would be a starter this year that you did not mention was DeLon Wright. I thought DeLon Wright, given his size and his defense and catch and shoot threes, and he has played point guard before, I thought that was going to be the guy.
Well, he did start a couple of games early. We found that he has played much more effectively off the bench. He's playing really well with Brunson and Hardaway.
I think you might be able to take me, Barea, Scott Tomlin, your PR guy who's in the room right now, and Dirk in whatever condition he's in, and like one other guy off the street, and your bench would be like +6 points per 100 possessions. I don't know what you guys do. These bench units are, it's just a motley crew every year, and every year it works.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's a motley crew, but.
You know what I mean? It's like the mix is always changing and you know.
I'm a little less optimistic about the team you just named, including you and Tomlin. And I don't know if you've seen Dirk lately.
I've heard tell.
He's been eating a lot of ice cream and, you know, but yeah, I mean, look, this is stuff we got to constantly figure out. And you know, the thing in coaching that you have to realize and remember is that, you know, these are not just analytic printout things and just pieces that you move around. I mean, these are human beings that need to be communicated with. About all these different kinds of things and talk to, and there's quite a bit involved with it.
If there's a moment from your coaching career that I asked Dirk this when he came on my podcast last year, that I just want to ask everybody involved with it what they remember of it, it's Game 2 in Miami of the finals that you won in 2011 when Wade hits the three in front of your bench and preens a little bit and you guys are down, I don't know, it was like 16 or 18 or something in the second half and there's a timeout. I mean, that is a capital N moment. That is like, this is it. Like you go down 2-0, it's really hard to come back from 2. I know you haven't played a home game yet in that series. You got all three of your home games coming to you. But I just wonder, what is your flashbulb memory of that timeout? When you're 100 years old, what are you going to remember from that timeout?
Well, I remember the moment pretty vividly. I don't exactly remember what we talked about in the timeout, but people were upset. I know we talked about, hey, we got 5.5, 6 minutes. Let's continue to play. Let's put pressure on these guys. You know, there's a lot of possessions left and let's see if we can give ourselves a chance. And that's exactly what happened. I don't remember the entire sequence of that game, but I remember that. You know, Dirk hit a big three, I think, to either tie it or put us up three. And then we had a defensive lapse. They threw the ball over to Chalmers, and he banged in a three to tie it.
Jet screwed up, I believe, right?
Well, I don't want to get into
someone screwed
up. You know, naming names about it. But we had a breakdown. And then, you know, we had basically 10 or 12 seconds or 7 or 8 or whatever it was. And it was, hey, get the ball to Dirk. And it was an elbow ISO. He got it. Miami had no timeouts. He was able to lay the ball in. And then Wade got it, and he took a half-court shot and missed. And so, you know, that was a series changer for us because now we're 1-1 going home. And then we lost Game 3 in that series.
People forget that one.
To go down 1-2. And at that point, you know, if you look at metrics and analytics and probabilities and math and all that kind of stuff, I believe our probability of winning the series at that point would have been very, very low based upon the fact that we were down a game and we had just lost a game at home. But we won Game 4, we won Game 5, and we won Game 6. And it was really quite an amazing experience.
True or false, the morning of Game 6 in Miami, you gather the coaches on your staff and say, we're all taking a shot of Mountain Dew for good luck.
There was a couple guys that did, yeah.
Just a couple?
Yeah. Well, not all of our guys were Mountain Dew drinkers, but...
I didn't know you were until a person who shall not be named told me this story.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's...
Did you have shot glasses?
It's a habit that I've done better. I've tapered it down over the years. But I'll tell you what, it's a tough one. It's an addictive drink. And... But I remember a couple guys that did. One other guy on the staff was a Mountain Dew drinker at the time, and you know, we used to joke about shots, you know, but that wasn't the entire staff.
Okay. I thought it was the whole coaching staff. Did you have shot classes? Was it proper shots?
No, during that series, I was in a suite at the Four Seasons, in Miami downtown. And, I don't know, there was a lot of different kinds of glasses and silverware and all kinds of stuff. And so there were some really small ones. And so we just poured one or two of those, and I think that was
okay. Well, it worked. The most famous visual memory, I think, from that series was Dirk leaving the floor as it was ending to go compose himself. And the story's been told and retold about your staff and the NBA staff having to go in the locker room and be like, dude, you're going to regret this if you don't come out. You've just won the championship. Do you have any realization that the best player on our team has vanished? Do you know where he is? Did you register that at all?
Yeah, I was aware that he had left. I figured it was just a very emotional thing. You know, I was one of the ones that went back to get him.
Well, I didn't know that. I think I forgot that.
There were a couple of us that did. And then he came out. He just was, you know, he was extremely emotional about it. I mean, this was the one defining moment that his career lacked. And, you know, to finally get there, I mean, most of us remember the image of the first title that Jordan won. You know, he had the trophy and he was weeping. You know, he was so emotional that he was crying. And, this kind of moment can elicit these kinds of human responses. And that's why our league is so compelling.
What is your, again, the flashbulb image that just comes into your mind, the thing, or maybe it's a conversation and some, whatever is the first thing that pops into your mind. You were the coach of the Pacers during the Malice in the Palace. I mean, that is maybe the craziest thing that's happened in the NBA in the last whatever years. Like, what's your most vivid image of that?
Well, I'll give you a couple things on that. I don't talk about that incident, generally speaking, because I just don't. You know, at the five-year anniversary of it, I had a bunch of media people come at me about it. You know, I just was I refused to talk about it. The 10-year anniversary came. You know, I just stayed away from it. What I will tell you is that with everything that happened, there was not one significant injury that came out of that whole thing, miraculously. Okay. And that's one of the greatest blessings that came out of it. And the net result was that security beefed up universally in the league. And that has been a great thing over the years. You know, it's just something that was an experience, I think, that is best not to talk about anymore.
You guys rode out that season stronger than people remember.
Listen, I think we were 4-0 at the time or something like that. We went home the next night and we had some guys suspended. The suspensions were staggered because there were so many of them. And, you had to have 8 guys available to play, but because a couple guys were banged up, we only had 6 and we almost won that game. And then we won our next 3 home games, which were all against pretty good teams. It was like Boston, Minnesota, and one other one. And then we went out on the West Coast and we just got bombed in some games. And, we had 3 guys from the minor leagues that were filling in. But then over time, we were gradually able to kind of put the roster back together. You know, Reggie Miller started out that season injured with a broken hand. He came back. Of course, that was going to be a big lift to us. And we ended up, I believe, going 22-7 to end the season.
Wow.
To get to 44 wins and get to a first round series with Boston. And we were the 6th seed. They were the 3 seed and we beat them. And that was, you know, it was a very big moment for the franchise because we had really weathered a storm, on a lot of levels. And it put us into a second round series with who else but Detroit.
Yeah.
We lost in 6, but we competed well. And the memorable thing for me about that series was that, you know, Reggie Miller's last game as a professional was game 6, where he was the leading scorer, I believe, on the floor and went out with great, great dignity. And so that season was difficult. It was trying, but, you know, some very good things came out of it.
Speaking of Reggie Miller, another game. It's not a forgotten game. People remember it, especially people my age. But I, for some reason in the annals of the Jordan 6 championships, I don't know why it's not remembered as well. That 98 conference finals, you were an assistant coach on that Pacers team. That was a bloodbath. And that game 7 was like, I don't know if either team is coming out of this series alive. And they only won it because Michael, just sheer force of will, I don't know how many free throws he ended up taking. It was a lot. It's a remarkable series to me because I'm 42 years old. I was a high school kid mostly during Michael's prime, around that age, high school, college, whatever. You just could never believe that his team would lose. He's the only athlete that I've ever felt that way about, that they were just inevitable. And you guys were the one team that were like, you're not inevitable. But maybe the Knicks, the early 90s Knicks also pushed them to the brink. But you guys by the end were the only ones.
Well, we played them well. And we had also won one of our regular season games in Chicago a little later in the year. So our guys had a strong belief that they could be beaten and that we could beat them. You know, I'll never forget it. You'd be fine today for doing it, but for game 7, we all went over on the bus together at the same time. We went very late so that nobody would have to talk to the media. and it was just, the team was very together. We got off to a great start. We were up 14 in the first half.
I thought you guys were going to win. I remember thinking, I can't believe what's happening here.
Yeah, the key play in the game was a jump ball that we, did not control. The ball kicked around. So Rick Smits, who's 7'4", was jumping against a smaller guy. The ball got kicked around and ended up in Steve Kerr's hands, and he hit a three to tie it. And this is with, I don't know, I want to say 4.5 minutes, something like that. And then it was kind of like the deluge hit and we just couldn't keep it together, you know, and they ended up winning. I don't know what the final margin was. It was close,
yeah.
But they kind of won going away, and it was very, very bittersweet. I mean, 'cause we had competed so well, but it was, you know, one of those opportunities of a lifetime that we just came up short with.
People, hiring can be a slow process. Cafe Altura's COO, Dylan Miskowitz, needed to hire a director of coffee for his organic coffee company, but he was having trouble finding qualified applicants. So he switched to ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you, it finds them for you. Its technology identifies people with the right experience and invites them to apply for your job proactively, so you get quality candidates fast. Dylan posted his job on ZipRecruiter and said he was impressed by how quickly he had great candidates apply. He also used ZipRecruiter's candidate rating feature to filter his applicants so he could focus on the most relevant ones. And that's how Dylan found his new director of coffee in just a few days. With results like that, it's no wonder 4 out of every 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within one day. See why ZipRecruiter is effective for businesses of all sizes? Try ZipRecruiter for free at our web address, ZipRecruiter.com/lowpost. That's ZipRecruiter.com/lowpost, LOWEPOST, the name of this podcast. ZipRecruiter.com/lowpost. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Two quick questions and I'll let you go. 86 Celtics, you're on that team. Did you want the Lakers or did you just want to win the championship and you didn't care?
Well, everybody assumed it was going to be the Lakers. I'll never forget, I was in a restaurant watching game 1 of LA and Houston, and Kareem got the ball inside and he went up for a hook. He got fouled. He scored. And I'll never forget, the camera panned over to Jack Nicholson, and I could read Nicholson's lips. He said, ball game. And it just seemed like this is how it was going to go. And then Houston got on a roll and beat them, I believe, 4 consecutive games, mm-hmm. culminating in the play where, you know, they lobbed the ball up to Sampson and he, you know, simultaneously caught it, turned, and one-timed it in from, you know, whatever it was, 12, 14 feet. And all of a sudden it was us and them. And they played well in the final series. We won in 6.
People remember that series as a walkover, and it wasn't.
There was a couple things that happened, I believe, in game 3 that allowed them to win game 3 and then get to game 4, you know, with only a 1-game difference. I believe we won game four and then lost game five, and then we went home and won game six. And game six was not close. You know, that was...
It's an all-time Larry game.
That was, you know, that was just a wild and crazy Boston Garden. And, you know, Houston was a team that was, you know, they were probably best described as an upstart team that got to that point, but they probably really weren't ready for that moment, you know, whereas the Lakers certainly, you know, had a history and would have been. But, hey, that was that year, and it was an amazing run. It was an amazing group of guys. I think there's at least five Hall of Famers, possibly six, if you count, you know, Walton, Bird, McHale, Parrish, Dennis Johnson. Maybe it is only five. And, you know, it was a brand of basketball that was just absolutely beautiful to watch.
Last one. A couple of your old head veterans said, I have to ask you this, and I think they know the answer, so they may be putting me in a troublesome spot here. He said, ask Rick why he used to tape his ankles before coaching games.
Well, you know, when I played, I always taped my own ankles. And
what a world, huh?
What happened was it was a little bit of a, you know, I let the players in on it metaphorically a little bit, just to let a, as kind of a symbol of, hey, we're strapping up and getting ready to go here, you know. But the truth was, I think I had some new shoes, and, you know, I have very long, narrow feet. And so when I would get a pair of shoes, the break-in period was sometimes a little longer than normal, and my heels would sometimes blister up. So I would apply elastic tape, you know, so that my heels wouldn't get shredded. And so that's the inside scoop on that. And, you know, fortunately now I've found a, you know, a shoe company that makes shoes that are pretty soft when you first put them on. And that's saved the team a lot of expense on tape.
Look at that. You got shoes. You got a room full of Mountain Dew at your hotel. Good stuff. Rick Carlisle, good luck. It's going to be a really interesting season. You got a really interesting team. And it's been fun to watch you over the years, and I'm really appreciative that you took some time to come on.
Always a pleasure, Zach.
The Low Post is presented by Goodyear. Drive always discovers possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.